When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
You're listening to Awakening Code Radio. Mind-expanding, heart-opening, talk and music to raise your vibration.
Some people consider it the shifting of the ages. Others see it as a whole new paradigm for humanity. But whatever you want to call it, it's hard to deny that we are in a moment of immense change. A moment challenging us to wake up and live life more consciously. This is Eric Rankin.
And I'm Michelle Anderson, and you're listening to Awakening Code Radio.
Where the conversation is always about raising the vibration of love, compassion,
happiness, forgiveness, stewardship, health, and peace.
Thank you for joining the conversation.
This is Deepak Chopra.
Hi, I'm Marianne Williamson.
Hi, this is Greg Braden, and you are listening to Awakening Code.
Awakening Code.
Awakening Code Radio.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here on Awakening Code Radio. We call our show Conversation to Raise the Vibration, and believe it or not, we've been doing it for over 10 years in the beautiful KXFM studios right here in downtown Laguna Beach, California, broadcasting all over the world. If you're a streamer, thank you for listening at whatever time and place you happen to be. Most of our listeners are podcast listeners to the tune of hundreds of thousands, over 100,000. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's more than I ever thought. What else do we want to say? Michelle, do you have anything before you want? Oh, you know what? I've never mentioned my book anymore. Go buy my book.
Eric.
As Above, So Below, The Quantum Teachings of Jesus on Amazon. It's doing really good. All I'll say about it.
Shameless.
Yeah, totally shameless. And we're excited to be headed out to Contact in the Desert in 2 days. It's going to be exciting.
It is, and you are speaking this year, Friday morning, 9 a.m.
Yep. We're kicking it off together Thursday in the afternoon, leading people out to a giant rock. And the backstory there of one of the most infamous or famous UFO encounters of recent times, 1952 and 3, George Van Tassel made contact with Ashtar Command. Maybe some of you people have heard of that. Sounds very much like Ashtar Command was the Star Trek, representing the Federation of Planets, watching out for planet Earth and couldn't share too much information with us, although maybe they did. A lot of people think we've backwards engineered a lot of things that we received from extraterrestrials in the early 1950s. And we're going to be talking a lot about that with our guests this evening. Are we ready to bring Paul up?
You know what? I'm still adding the post to my story on Instagram because I forgot to do that earlier. And I'm super excited about how easy the show was to put together because we have such a great guest. He's really an amazing guy who I met at Conscious Life Expo in February. I was supposed to intro him and somebody stole him away from me, but we had some camaraderie going on in the hallway because I didn't get to intro him. So, and now I'm introducing him at Contact in the Desert.
Fun. So, and you read me his bio as I was driving home.
He's like the master of everything.
He's like the most interesting man in the world. I mean, I was like, that's a bio right there. This guy's done, he's lived more lives in one than we ever get to, you know.
And that's the thing. I didn't really know what to title the show tonight, but one of the things, he can talk about so many things. We're talking about Paul Hynek. Are you with us, Paul?
I am. Hello, Michelle. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show. I know things are, you know, getting hectic as we amp up to head out to the desert, and everybody's getting all excited for Contact in the Desert. And I reached out to you on it was only yesterday, Memorial Day, and just said, do you want to be on the show? And you absolutely said yes right away and so professional. And when I asked you, what do you want to talk about? Because you are so diverse. You could talk about so many things. And you said you could talk about UFOs, to proving the reality of supernatural encounters, to DMT, to Bitcoin. I threw in there AI. You didn't say that, but I know that you have things to say and share about AI and astronomy. And so I, when our admin Colleen was asking me for a title for the show, I was like,
where do we start?
Much more than UFOs and Project Blue Book. That's what we called the show. Much more than UFOs and Project Blue Book, because what I realized when I was researching you, I didn't really know that much about you. And I when I do an introduction, I don't like to just read somebody's bio dry, because to me that's kind of boring. But your bio is, it's like a book in itself, and it is amazing. You've done so many different things. But what most people know you as is, they know you as the youngest son of Dr. J. Allen. And he was, you know, famous for being an astronomer who worked for the U.S. Air Force and investigating UFO cases from 1952 to 1969. And he's the person who the series Project Blue Book on the History Channel is based on. But when I read your bio, Paul, I was like, I bet you're so sick of talking about your childhood with your dad and UFOs and how your dad was a skeptic. And, you know, and then he got pulled in by the
short hairs.
I always want to. Eric Rankin, he got pulled in by the Air Force to, because he was skeptical, and they wanted him to do these interviews and find out. They kind of wanted him to debunk, it sounds like, you know.
First off, and anybody can chime in other than me, because I always ask the question. Michelle, you can answer this, or Paul, you can. Project Blue Book is maybe not a term that people are all familiar with. Do you want to give us a short definition of what Project Blue Book was?
Sure. So part of the job of the United States Air Force is to, project superiority in terms of power in the air and defend us against our foes who would do that to us. But a sort of a deeper level is also for them to project the image of their capability. So when flying saucers, this is a couple generations back, now they're fancy and dressed up for the ball and called UAPs, but most of my life they're UFOs, and before that they were flying saucers. When after World War II, when there was a lot of hysteria, frankly, about little green men and ray guns and flying saucers, the Air Force determined that their image of protecting us from everything in the sky was, you know, really taking it on the chin. So they created a series of agencies and departments, Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Blue Book. And Project Blue Book is the best known and the longest lasting. It lasted about 20 years. And it wasn't really a serious scientific effort to investigate UFOs, but it was more of a PR exercise to tamp down the hysteria. So they reached out to my father, who was an astrophysicist, and who had security clearance from having worked on proximity fuses during the war, and asked him to come and basically explain away these goofy flying saucer incidents or reports. And I think he thought it was probably all of a couple weekends worth of work. But over the 20 years he was involved with it, he went from somebody who thought there was nothing to it to somebody who's convinced that there was a phenomena that merited scientific study. That doesn't mean that it's extraterrestrial, and I actually lean against extraterrestrial. It could be something even more exotic, but that there was a phenomena there. So that's what Project Blue Book was the public-facing agency that the Air Force created to sort of take down the temperature in the public about flying saucers.
Yeah, and, you know, 1952-53 was such a watershed year, like just an eruption all over the world, but primarily in the United States, of people seeing what, back, like you said, we're calling UFOs. In fact, I mentioned George Van Tassel. He supposedly got a download from this Ashtar command and said, we're going to be flying our what we were calling at the time Foo Fighters over Washington, D.C. And he wrote a certified letter to the tower at, it wasn't called JFK back then, and the White House, and described what he had heard. And within a week, we have one of these more famously known UFO flyovers over Washington where pilots saw it. It showed up on radar screens. It was like the most publicly witnessed UFO event in American history, yet most people have never heard about it.
Yeah, and President Truman scrambled fighter jets after the objects in the sky.
Yeah, and one of those is hanging in the Smithsonian Institute just for that reason. I'm overlapping my Integratron a little spiel that I give, but it's a fascinating thing. And whenever I mention this 1952 flyover and these lights in the sky and all this, and no one has ever heard of it, and everybody's heard of Roswell and Area 51 and all these other things, and I'm like, why would we not hear more about this encounter?
Well, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to know what kind of things will sort of capture the public's imagination for more than a few news cycles. Yeah. But that flap, as they call it, over Washington, D.C., was a serious affair. And it rattled a lot of people in the military establishment.
I could imagine and if it was real.
The ripples are really coming back around today. I think that's why so many people are finding out about these different programs on the History Channel with Ancient Aliens and with Project Blue Book is on the History Channel. They have a series called Skinwalker Ranch, which was about the supposed Navajo curse, where there's a lot of paranormal activity there. And they think that curse started in like 1864 or something like that in Utah. But I did find on an Instagram channel a little excerpt from the Project Blue Book series with the character that's playing your dad. And I wanted to play that real quickly just so people get a taste of what we're talking about here. And I don't want to spend too much time on this, Paul, because you're so fascinating in yourself. And I do want to talk about all the other areas that we mentioned and get you to unfold a lot more about who you are, not just being this man's son, but who you are as Paul yourself, because you are so fascinating. So I'm going to go ahead and play a little excerpt really quick, just about a minute and a half, and let's see if we can.
There's an urgent.
July of 47, Roswell, New Mexico. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, this was that crashed Army weather balloon.
You remember the first reports?
Invasion of the spaceman. My son wouldn't stop talking about it.
Yeah, when that story hit, it jammed phone lines nationwide. Broke a few switchboards in the process. War of the Worlds all over again.
You said on the phone that this concerned me recently.
Indianapolis, 48. Man sees strange. Papers catch on. Whole town goes nuts. Turns out to be migrating geese. Oregon, 49. Fisherman swears he sees a metallic disc covering a state park. Turns out to be a water tower. About 2 weeks ago, Manhattan, a college kid sees this unearthly.
That's the moon.
Took four Coast Guard vessels combing the Hudson for 2 days to arrive at that astute. That is why you're here. Our nation is suffering from a form of mass hysteria right now. One we can't afford. Not with Russia breathing down our necks in a nuclear arms race on the brink of disaster. When people panic, communication channels jam, police can't do their jobs, and the Border Patrol literally chases them. How would you like to help the U.S. Air Force instill rational scientific back into our public
health? How?
For starters, come meet a Fargo. Pilot there by the name of Henry Fuller claims to have gotten into a dogfight with an alien spacecraft.
You want me to investigate flying saucers?
I want you to help me prove to the public the truth.
I'm so sorry to interrupt.
What a fascinating twist to all of that. You know, that makes a great story anywhere, is you're hired to do one thing, to debunk, and then in the process, you get swept up in the story and the evidence of something is actually happening. And we know it now more than we did back then. But imagine that moment. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, funny thing happened on the way to the debunking parade.
Yes, exactly.
And I love when I found that clip today, Paul. I love that he's in the actor that's playing your father is saying my son. And I was curious, was that you? But how many do you have, brothers and sisters? You're the youngest son.
I have four brothers and one sister. There's a character in the show named Joel, and I have a brother named Joel, but he bears no resemblance to any of us. And I did go, and I became friends with the cast, including my TV dad, and went to the set several times and went on publicity junkets with him as well.
How fun.
Yeah, that sounds fun. And it seems like everybody's so, anytime I've seen anyone talk to you, they always want to know all about your childhood growing up and what it was like being in a home with, you know, where UFOs were talked about constantly. And yet you grew up to be a very accomplished financier, it sounds like. Your degrees are, you have way more than most people, I think, when it comes to, you know, your MBA from Wharton and being a professor of finance and accounting at Pepperdine. You don't do that anymore, do you? You're not a professor anymore?
I do. It's a hobby of mine. So I taught last semester, but I put my heart and soul in it. And it takes about 40 hours a week to pull off the way I do it. So I have to take time off. So I'll probably teach again maybe next year, but I've taught 9 semesters so far.
Wow. And you've raised $1 billion for thousands of startups. And I love part of your resume or your bio that talks about how you will speak anywhere, and if you're given 2 months notice, you'll do it in any language. Is that true? You're willing to learn any language?
Yeah, that's right. And I've done it so far in Argentina, and I was scheduled to do it in both Bulgaria and Italy, but they both got canceled. The conference organizers weren't able to pull it off. But yeah, I will do it in any language anywhere in the world.
That's nerves of steel right there. Most people are, including myself, I get nervous in front of a big audience. And, you know, here you are doing it in a non-native tongue. That's impressive, to say the least.
Yeah, languages are a passion of mine. And when I was invited to speak in Argentina for an hour, they had an Air Force general who was going to be my interpreter. But I realized, well, that will effectively cut my time in half and sever that connection that I'd otherwise make with the audience. So I don't need to be fluent in the language. I just need to have a very good translation that's aided by several native speakers, sprinkle in some local colloquialisms, and then be able to read it in a way that they can understand in a very animated fashion. And then it's just better. People like, you know, when you go to that effort, and it just resonates a little bit more when you speak in someone's native language.
That's so cool.
I think that's so stand up. It's stellar for you to do that. And it really shows your character. I'm curious about, you know, what got you into crypto. And it, you know, you talked about how you would talk about Bitcoin, or, you know, what got you into the crypto projects. And I'm curious what you think about this FedNow program. And it seems like we're on the brink of a lot of changes coming with the banking system. And I'm really curious where you stand on that and what your thoughts are.
Yeah, okay. So I've worked in a lot of cool industries, but I've never been intrigued and fascinated and pulled as much by any industry in my life as with crypto. And let's say Bitcoin in particular. There's a lot of misunderstandings about Bitcoin. It's good for the environment. It's good for the world. It's a vote for peace. And it's a way around the corrupt fiat systems that we have. All the currencies in the world are what are called fiat currencies. They're sort of declared by fiat by the government. And there's nothing that backs them. There's no gold that backs any currency now. And with Bitcoin, you've got mathematical certainty backing it. So it's like digital gold, but it's better than gold. And before long, Bitcoin will be millions of dollars per coin. And so here's an example. When we colonize Mars, which I think is imminent, what currency will they use? I don't think they're going to want to use the dollar and monitor Fed broadcasts to put their finger in the wind to see which way interest rates are going. I think they'll use Bitcoin. And then they'll get tired because they can't mine it, and they'll mine their own coin called Mars coin, and then Bitcoin will start being called Earth coin, I think. And I believe that all civilizations throughout the universe, once they get to a certain technological level, if they don't have magic, and if they have citizens that have individualized economic interests, will develop something akin to a Bitcoin, a proof of work consensus, representation of value, And that's a largely a way that we will communicate with other civilizations. And people think that we are now sending out negative symbols to the galaxy because of our nuclear capabilities, and that may well be true. But I think something like Bitcoin is sending out positive waves into the galaxy that we are now on the cusp of being ready to join whatever federation there may be out there that awaits us.
What a great explanation. I'm so glad you broke it down like that, Paul, because, you know, a lot of people, I'm not really well-versed in it. We tried to do a show once, I think, about the whole crypto market and talk about Bitcoin and Ethereum, and it's pretty much over mine and Eric's head. But to me, that reminds me of when, you know, cell phones came out and I didn't want to use a cell phone because it was intimidating, right?
Or text.
Yeah, yeah. And or even, you know, you got on to Facebook and then your kids were doing Instagram and then nobody wanted to do Instagram. They still wanted to do Facebook. And it just shows, you know, there are early adopters and then there are people that take a while to cross the chasm, right? And I'm usually one of the laggards, I think they call me.
Luddite.
Yeah.
Would explain,
you're a Luddite, yeah.
Yeah, explain me. But, you know, if I pull away far enough, because I'm not super digitally minded, but I have said numerous times, going back many years, that we are at the threshold where we're moving out of the analog existence, where everything is kind of brute force and resistance and every way we do it, to a digital age. So it would make sense, while I'm not jumping in both feet to no paper currency and every transaction you ever make is going to be monitored and known and just more information for whoever it is watching all this stuff, following us and monitoring us to control us and our buying habits and everything, it does completely make sense that we would, 1,000 years from now, is like, wait a minute, you traded pieces of paper, and everyone just said yes, that had value and would store those pieces of paper. And
it feels like Monopoly.
Yeah. And I guess if everyone is in this digital realm, nothing else would make sense.
Now back to more Awakening Code Radio.
Can you also speak to what BRICS is?
Wait, he didn't answer my question.
I want him to go into that and then speak to what BRICS is before I ask that. I want him to start thinking about that as
What BRICS is? I don't know what BRICS is.
Or you don't about Brazil, Russia, India, and China?
Sure. I was thinking that it's some kind of crypto coin.
Well,
yeah, it's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and I forget that. Maybe Spain? I don't know. But
it's Saudi Arabia, too, I think.
Yeah. One of the things that we're seeing is that's troubling, whether or not you like crypto or Bitcoin, is that we have had an unfair advantage since 1945 in the U.S. of being the de facto global reserve currency. And that is now starting to decline as other countries, Saudi Arabia and others, are now buying and selling oil in Chinese yuan as opposed to the dollar. So in addition to banking problems, which you mentioned, Michelle, which are systemic and growing, we've got groups of people around the world, BRICS and other factions, that are moving away from the dollar hegemony. And that spells a lot of trouble for us in the U.S. for our economy, because we're just not able to lead the world around by the nose anymore.
Right. We're only 5%. It sounds to me like we're 5% of the global population, and it's 60% that's moving away from the U.S. dollar. Is that right?
Well, I think it's just a rising drumbeat of countries that are tired of having the U.S. dictate economic policy to them. You know, we started this out with the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1945 saying, hey, whole world, give us your gold. We'll hold on to it, and we'll only print enough, as many dollars as we have gold to back it. But we lied. And by 1971, you know, de Gaulle from France sent a tanker to collect their gold, and Nixon had to admit, okay, we lied, no more gold standard, and we abandoned the gold standard.
Hmm. 1971.
Yeah.
So what do you predict is going to happen in these coming months?
You know, it's very hard to know. There was a guy who's well-known in the crypto space who predicted that Bitcoin would go to $1 million by sometime in June. I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, inflation is very high, and this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. Our government all governments around the world are corrupt in how they abuse people. You know, inflation, if you think about it, is theft because they're watering down the value of our dollars. You know, there's no gold to the concept of the U.S. dollar is backed by the full faith and confidence of the United States government, but the integrity and value of each unit isn't backed by anything. And, you know, a house 50 years ago, a nice house cost maybe $20,000. There's no reason it should cost more now. This is chronic, rampant corruption on the part of governments who spend, they just make money when they want to. And we printed trillions of dollars during the pandemic. And that never ends well. It's never ended well in history, and it's not going to end well now, unfortunately.
Yeah, and they print it for themselves. They don't print it for us. Well, I guess they did, you know, when we got in California, we got a stimulus check here and there, you know, but not enough to change anybody's life. But when the government's in trouble, they get to do something we don't get to do. They get to print money. And I'm like, this whole thing just feels like I'm no expert in economics or any of this, but it feels like it's been a house of cards for decades now.
Yeah. You know, if there was no economic consequence to printing money, they would just print all the money they wanted and they wouldn't have to collect taxes from us. But there, every time you print money, all the money that exists already is devalued. And it's debasement of the currency. And just mathematically, it's not going to work. It's basically, when we do this, we're kicking the can down the road and saying our children and our grandchildren will bear the problems. Well, unfortunately, we're now bearing the problems created by our grandparents.
And so it goes. I had, you know, the personal, if a lot of people living in the United States might hear about such things like this, but not really have any tactile connection to it. But I remember going to Mexico in the 90s or so when it used to be 7-8 pesos to a dollar, and then it went to 700 pesos to a dollar, like overnight. Yeah. A loaf of bread was 2,000 and a car was 2 million, and then they, I don't know how they massaged it back into place to be, you know, kind of where it is now, more stable. But it feels like as soon as you just go, we can just print more money, that's easy. It's a quick fix. It's not a quick fix.
Yeah. And so people talk about Bitcoin being volatile and they don't understand it, but it was created specifically in response to the 2008 financial crisis. And it's a responsible, sober currency alternative that's beyond the grasp and the corruption of any particular government.
I think you have one of our listeners, Mavani, I just want to thank her for writing in. She said, best and most inspiring explanation of Bitcoin that I've heard yet. And I totally agree with that. Do you have any do you have any crypto projects that you're interested in, that you're looking at, that, you know, I don't want to say tips for our listeners, but, you know, directions that we can look in that are going to benefit the planet, that are for the greatest good for all? Just throw some stuff out that we could do our own research on.
Sure. So I've been involved with about 20 different crypto companies, and I'm an active investor in about 30 or 4 crypto coins and tokens. And for people who are interested, the advice I give to my friends and my family and my students is JBB, just buy Bitcoin. There are tens of thousands of cryptocurrencies, and it's overwhelming. The technology, the different categories, the plethora of different coins, it really is overwhelming. Bitcoin is different than any other cryptocurrency can ever be or any other fiat currency. And it's a vote for peace, and it's easy. You can buy it just like you buy a stock. You can go to Coinbase or other exchanges, very similar to having like an E-Trade account. And it's, if you sell it, you're taxed just like having a stock. It can never be taken away. Like, the American government has confiscated all of our gold. In the 1930s, they confiscated all individuals' gold. Bitcoin cannot be confiscated, and it's a vote for peace. So for people who are interested in that, there's a book, there are two books I recommend called Inventing Bitcoin and The Bitcoin Standard. The Bitcoin Standard is a bit more dense, but it has a wonderful summary of financial history that is eye-opening for people who haven't had a chance to look at that before. So the first 8 chapters don't talk about Bitcoin at all, but they talk about why we have problems when governments abuse currency and can just print it willy-nilly with no immediate consequences. So the Bitcoin Standard and Inventing Bitcoin are great places to start. There's a wonderful website called hope.com, which is all about Bitcoin and has lots of videos and other resources. And one of the things I've seen is that I've talked to a lot of people about Bitcoin, and some people love it, some people hate it, some people are scared by it, some people are indifferent. But I've never met anybody who spent more than 20 hours studying it who didn't come away as a convert.
So the question, I can hear some listener in my head right now, not literally, if it's just JBB, right before you said that, you said, I have investments in 30 or 40 different other coins. Why would you do that?
Right. So that's a good question. So the reason is because I'm very familiar with the crypto space. So I spent the time to learn about all these other coins and tokens. And frankly, the only reason I have them, even though I've done a lot of research about them and I work for a lot of these companies, is because I think that perhaps in the short term, they will appreciate more than Bitcoin. But Bitcoin to me is like the board game Sorry, where you have your men going around the outside circle and the goal is to get them in the safe zone in the middle. Bitcoin is that financial safe zone. And so I'm playing with these other currencies because they're better than the dollar. And in the short run, I think they might do better than Bitcoin. Or I've been paid those because I've consulted with companies. But then before long, I want to convert them into Bitcoin.
So we've had some friends, personal friends, that bought Bitcoin, did make some good money, but then kind of took a beating on it. They didn't pull out. They all wish, oh, I wish I'd pull it all because, it devalued in the last couple of years quite a bit. What was the big devalue of Bitcoin?
Well, it hasn't really devalued very much. Nobody who's ever bought Bitcoin who didn't sell it has regretted it. Since Bitcoin was launched and had its first commercial transaction in May, 13 years ago this month, it has gone up 10 million fold.
Wow.
If you bought $1 Bitcoin 13 years ago, it would be $10 million now.
Wow.
We've never seen anything in our lives like this. So did it go down last year? Yeah. But it's still up right now, 10 million fold from where it was introduced just a bit more than a decade ago.
Wow.
So does it have periodic ups and downs? Yeah. But it is by far and away the best performing asset in the history of mankind.
Wow. So you said if somebody bought a dollar and they would have 10 million now, are you saying that one Bitcoin is worth $10 million? That's not correct, is it?
No. So what I'm saying is if you had spent $1 to buy Bitcoin 13 years ago, and that would have bought you a lot of Bitcoin.
Oh, I see.
Because the initial price was a quarter of a penny.
Oh, I gotcha.
It's gone up by 10 million fold now.
Wow.
And one last thing I'll say about Bitcoin is that Fidelity Investments, which is hardly a fly-by-night financial operation, has made one prediction that I know of in their history about the long-term price prediction of an asset class, and that's Bitcoin. And Fidelity Investments, and people can look this up, they predicted that one Bitcoin in 15 years will be worth $1 billion.
Will the whole global economy shift around that, where $1 billion, if everybody has that or access to it, if so many people are billionaires, will it mean less? Will a house now be $1 billion?
Yeah, that's a good point. So unfortunately, it's not just pure wine and roses that Bitcoin here to save the world. If Bitcoin does get to $1 billion, which I think it will, that means that the dollar has depreciated so much that it might not be a great world to live in, because, Bitcoin can't just come and save the world from the financial crimes that we've committed. It can help, but being worth $1 billion is against the dollar. So it's either Bitcoin appreciating and or the dollar depreciating. So that could mean very rough seas financially. And frankly, I don't want to live in a world where I've been fortunate enough to get a bunch of Bitcoin and the overall economy is collapsing. That's a rather dystopian scenario. I hope that Bitcoin will steadily appreciate and people can understand it and make educated decisions for what's right for them, and that we still have the dollar, but it's just not viewed the same way it is today.
And the value of Bitcoin at this moment is what per coin?
About $28,000.
$28,000. And there's actual experts, financial experts, are thinking that by June or July, it could be worth, you said $1 million?
Well, no, there's one guy, his first name is Balaji. He's very well known in the crypto space, who predicted it will go to $1 million this June. I don't think it's going to happen.
That would be an astronomical jump.
Yeah, it really would be.
That's fascinating. We could do a whole 10 shows on this. I think there could be a podcast about this whole thing.
This is my favorite conversation about Bitcoin, because it's less about understanding how it works and just knowing that there's a bigger, broader picture. Yeah.
I appreciate that you brought that perspective, Paul. I had a feeling you were the guy to do that, because we've had other people talk about it. But when I read over, you know, many of the areas that you could talk about, this one is what really caught my attention, just because it's in our faces right now, and I want to get a little bit better understanding of what's happening there, and you really brought that home for me. I'm also very curious about what this FedNow program is. Do you know what that is? My friend's credit union sent her a letter saying they're joining the FedNow program. And I've heard that that's not a mandatory thing. They don't have to do that, but many of the banks are implementing this thing. Do you have an overview or an opinion on what that is?
Well, FedNow in itself is fairly innocuous. It's just a way for banks to connect to the Fed system easier. But what I will say is that the Fed is a corrupt institution.
Thanks for saying that.
I was right all along.
This is not Democratic or Republican, but the Fed is, you know, it's like, look, are either of you deliriously happy with the service and the return on investments you get from your bank?
No.
Yeah. Deliriously. I think that's the right tone. No. Yeah. Because they provide crappy service, and they give very small return.
Right.
The Fed is behind all this stuff, and they're the ones that you know, gerrymander. This is supposed to be a democracy with a free market, but they're the ones that, by fiat, declare what interest rates will be. That's not how a free market is supposed to act. It's supposed to be the millions and millions of voices of consumers who decide, and, you know, where the economy should go. The Fed, the scary thing is that they want to introduce CBDCs, which are basically country digital currencies. And so they want to replace the paper dollar with a digital dollar. Well, now they can confiscate that at any time. They can track them all the time. So what scant personal freedom we have in the financial arena is gone. And that is no substitute for something like a Bitcoin, which is not created by a government. A digital dollar is basically a worse version of paper dollars, and that's what the Fed is pushing for.
How do we stop it?
Oh, boy, I don't know.
Do we use more cash? Do we encourage people to use more cash?
I have a friend that just bought pretty much all the money they had, almost $100,000, and bought gold. Is that a wise move?
Well, in short term, if you think the dollar is going off a cliff, yes. Long-term, gold is the worst investment in history. It hasn't even kept pace with the official version of inflation. If you look back to the year 1800 until now, gold hasn't even kept up with inflation. So anything longer than a short-term emergency, gold is a horrible investment.
Hmm. Oh, boy.
Because a lot of people think, well, I have a tangible thing, and it's going to be valuable in some way, whether it's to industry or technology or something. So I've got this thing in hand that has some value, and everything else, including myself, you think digital, that's a ether, you flip the power switch and nobody has anything.
Yeah, right. It's hard to sort of get your arms around that. But again, in the 1930s, that tangible thing was confiscated by the U.S. government. Yeah. And they cannot confiscate a Bitcoin.
And what happens, I guess, we don't have to worry about if there's a global EMP and the whole global grid goes down, we've got a whole bunch of other things to worry about.
That's right. We got bigger issues to worry about than whether you have gold or Bitcoin. You got marauding bands of people coming to your house.
Now back to more Awakening Code Radio.
One of the other things that you said you wanted to touch upon, and I, you know, we still have a good 20 minutes or a half hour or so to cover some more ground. I'm curious about when you say you want it, you're willing to talk about DMT, and where would you take that conversation if we switch subjects?
Wow, that is a major DMT. Switching of subjects.
That's a major switching of subjects, but I like where you're going, Paul. You're bringing us to a hopeful place. You know, you're spelling things out, but you're also not leaving me feeling hopeless.
Oh, okay, good. So DMT, I was having lunch with a friend of mine who's a fascinating guy who crash-landed tardigrades on the moon, which is a pretty cool accomplishment. And he knew about my father, and he asked me one day, hey, Paul, where did your father think that UFOs come from? I said, well, you know, it's one thing for a scientist to say there's a phenomena. Where they come from, we don't know. But he thought, like Jacques Vallée and others, that the extraterrestrial hypothesis could well be part of it, but didn't encompass all aspects of the phenomena. And so he thought, you know, perhaps it's interdimensional. So my friend said, well, you should read a book called Alien Information Theory. And I said, Alien Information Theory? Sexiest book title ever. Of course I'll read it. What's it about? He said, well, it's about DMT. And I said, okay, what's DMT? He said, it's the most powerful psychedelic drug known on Earth. Ayahuasca is one variant of it that's better known than its sort of bigger brother DMT. And I said, that's fascinating. And he said, look, this book talks about the possibility that this drug is not necessarily a hallucinogenic, but a kind of Aldous Huxley door to another reality. And I said, well, wow, because if my dad thought UFOs might come from another dimension and DMT experiences might thrust you into another dimension, I should give that a try. A couple hours later, I met a new guy, a new friend of mine. He started talking about what he does. He said, oh, by the way, I facilitate DMT trips. So what's the universe saying? And he said, do you want to do it right now? I said, whoa, I can't, but I can do it in 2 weeks when I come back from vacation. So I did. I took one for the team, Michelle and Eric, and I got in this place, and I asked, after I said, hey, thanks for having me. You got to be polite. Are you what we perceive to be behind UFOs and aliens? I just blurted that shit out. And the answer I got back was like millions of miles of synapses and neurons. And the answer was, we can't explain in a way that you would understand.
So you're speaking English, and I've heard, I have not had a DMT experience myself, but I have talked to people that have, and I think it's incredible that many mention seeing like elfish or gnomish creatures they can communicate with. And in English, is that your experience?
Yeah, so I didn't really see any creatures, and I felt there was intelligence all around me, and it felt, even though I can't really categorize anything, it felt more feminine because it was more nurturing. That's the sort of the vibe I got. I just knew there was intelligence all around me. And when they gave me that answer, it wasn't condescending. And I started thinking about it. I said, well, look, if DMT, you know, if aliens are related to DMT and ghosts and other phenomena, I could see that that connective tissue, that could well be beyond my ability to understand it.
Mm.
I've done DMT a lot now, and I find it fascinating. Some of the most enriching experiences of my life. And I'm not encouraging people to go out and try it. It's a very serious, sober experience that you need to be sort of prepared for.
Absolutely.
But in my case, I may or may not have done psychedelic drugs in my younger days. I may or may not have had hair down past my shoulders. And so the chance to try to experience a potential research avenue standing on my father's shoulders was too good to pass up.
Hypothetically, if you had done mushrooms or LSD or something like that, how do you think you would compare DMT to those?
Ah, Yeah, hypothetically, I would add up all the drugs that I may or may not have done in my life and multiply them by a billion.
Holy moly.
And that would be about 1 second of what a 15-minute DMT experience might be like.
Well, hypothetically, I might know somebody who wants to give that a... in the name of science and experimentation. I've heard from people that they are blown away, as you were describing, but they don't remember much and they can't articulate much about it. They describe a knowing, they describe a vision, they describe this connectivity, but they've like, I don't even feel like I have the words to express what just happened.
Yeah, I one way I look at it is let's imagine you're in a planetarium and they have like 1,000 TV monitors all around you. How much of that can you take in at any one time? And then of that, you remember 1,000,000%. And that is still one of the most impactful experiences that you've had.
Wow.
But the ability to articulate it. I mean, Joe Rogan had a really good description, I think, saying that it's like complex geometric patterns built of love and understanding.
Wow. Holy moly.
That's the best description I've heard.
That's something. I was going to ask something.
That sounds like the female version of God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the last time I may have done it, I felt that it was heaven, not because it was like just sort of unlimited bliss, but that it was so fascinating that I could experience that same sensation for eternity and never tire of it.
Mm. Well, yeah, if you're looking at a million portals or what you describe as a TV screen, he's like, well, how about I go through that one? And how about then over that one? I mean, I know what I was going to think. Right. So you're very familiar with when we talk about ancient alien theory and everything like that. And we have all of these murals around the world of these sky visitors that look incredibly similar to each other. Tall beings with beards and long either cone heads or hats. The Anunnaki would express that. And so many of them are carrying this little bag that's always represented the same way, just this upside down U handle and a little square bag. And everyone's like, what's in that bag? I've always said, I think it is a mind altering substance. And maybe it was something like DMT, you know, that because there's so many theories that say it was psychedelics that brought us, separated us from primates and everything else that made us start asking questions or wondering what God is or our place in the universe.
Yeah, a bunch of tripping apes way back in history.
what do you think of the little bag holding something like TMT?
Yeah, it's any type of drug, you have to be careful and judicious about your usage, and you have to be ready for it.
Yes.
You have to do it in a safe environment. But, you know, psychedelic drugs have enjoyed a large resurgence in clinical prestige.
Yes.
There are a lot of, ketamine is used routinely now for depression. And there have been experiments recently, especially with psilocybin and ecstasy, that show long-lasting beneficial effects for people suffering depression and anxiety. And I think we're going to see sort of paralleling the trend for cannabis to be legalized, that the stigma, much like flying saucers used to have, associated with psychedelic drugs, will really diminish. And I think we're going to start seeing movements not of random, irresponsible, recreational use, but of deliberate, exploratory, therapeutic, and research interest.
Yes, and I hope that happens for sure. Listener, if you happen to be listening and think, oh, I want to do that at the next party I go to, I would be the first person to say, no, that is not what you want to do. This is sacred intent. This is, I've never done, hypothetically, one way or another, or would I do any psychedelics in a party? I'm very resistant to even shared communal experiences. I have not done ayahuasca. Something about the going to a place in a communal area that just, I'm usually
taking on someone else's stuff.
Yeah. I'm just by myself in nature during the day. Hypothetically.
In your dreams.
In my dreams. And, it's always been an incredible experience.
Well, it sounds like you're going to be talking a little bit about that at Contact in the Desert, because I just read your Friday lecture. The one I'm introing you for is at 2:15 to 4 o'clock.
I'm there.
Right.
I had a feeling, because he even mentions in his write-up about what he's going to talk about, he says elves in there. It's in the write-up.
And after your introduction and my presentation, I'm then doing a 90-minute presentation with the author of Alien Information Theory. And we're going to be having a discussion together.
Wow.
The author of the book Alien Information Theory is going to be there. And you're going to be wonderful.
Yes. And I proposed to him that, look, I come from the UFO world. You come from DMTs. There might be some overlap. Why don't we have a panel discussion about that? So at 4:20, Andrew Gallimore, the author of Alien Information Theory, and I will have a nice long discussion about that.
I'm excited. I mean, I'm excited always about going to Contact. I'm excited to speak there. Michelle and I will be hosting an event, but I never know who should I go see over somebody else. And
I just gave you your tip.
Yeah.
I always bring you the people I feel resonate very much with you, Eric, because I know what you're into.
Incredible. Well, there's so much groundedness to how you express your ideas and everything. And that's where when people just start taking a hard right in Whoville, you know, or something, you express your knowledge in a way that is approachable by anybody at any level, what I've learned from you in these last 52 minutes. And that I appreciate that more than I can almost explain, because I don't know if it was Einstein who said, if you can't speak about it eloquently enough where a child don't understand it, you don't understand it well enough yourself. And I think that's so many speakers that they can't, I don't want to call it dumb and down, they just can't make the information approachable to the masses.
Right. Yeah, I'm writing a book called Growing Up with UFOs, and I'm shamelessly going to steal a phrase you just said, Eric, and title a chapter, Hard Right to Whoville.
I knew it. He gave such a chuckle when you said that. I loved it. Oh, gosh, Paul. There's so many other places I wanted to go with you, because I think AI is a really big thing
let's talk 7 minutes about AI.
And
7 minutes to the apocalypse.
And I did want to also mention very quickly, people can look this up, about the fact that you had a real experience with your human life extended, because you volunteered to be a guinea pig, more or less. Did I read that you actually gave yourself a shot in your belly, like, four times a day for weeks?
Four times a week for a year, and then a year and a half. And because of that, and it was the first trial ever approved by the FDA in furtherance of life extension as opposed to combating this or that disease, and it was supervised by the Stanford Neuroscience Institute, and the results were so successful that they were published in a peer-reviewed medical journal, and also it was featured on an episode of The Unexplained on the History Channel. I have the documented success of the most success in history in reversing my age.
Because you grew your thymus back? Is that what
I... That's right. Yeah. That's right. The thymus is behind your breastplate, and it's what creates T cells, which are thymus-enabled cells, which are essentially your white blood cells or immune system. And as you get older, men and women alike, your thymus shrinks or involutes to the tune of about 3% per year. So I'm a big fan of radical life extension, and it's widely acknowledged that the first step, the first necessary but not sufficient step, is the immune system. Because you can work on your telomeres and stem cells and what have you, but if you live a lot longer and your immune system is weak, you won't live longer. Yeah, so I'm very happy to have participated in this trial. And I'm now the CFO for the company.
I love that you're so diverse. And when I saw that, I wanted to give a mention so that people could actually look into that, because we could do a whole nother show on that.
Yeah.
And a whole nother show on AI. I know you're my new favorite.
I think we should. It's odd that a fan of my work, he's reached out a couple times in the last couple of years, and he talks about this anti-aging conference, and it's going to be in Anaheim or someplace this year.
Oh, Radfest.
Radfest.
Probably Radfest, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it is. Are you involved in that at all?
I have been. I won't be going this year, but I've spoken and I've been involved, and I know the organizers, and that's basically my tribe.
Hmm. All right, we'll just drop the Radfest teaser out there. Let's drop
we'll talk
in,
about
in,
it on another show. Yeah, but six let's or drop seven in minutes. For a minute about AI.
Good, okay, cool. Good or bad?
So AI is a tool. You know, the Wright brothers, when they created, you know, aviation for the modern world, they were convinced that it would end warfare because people could fly over and see armies. They didn't think about the fact that you could drop bombs on the armies. So AI is a tool, good and bad. And because it's so powerful, it has more risks and more returns than tools before. It's, you know, if you think about it, if a government or a non-nation state actor, there are, I think, two things that would confer upon them complete superiority over the rest of the world. One of them would be reverse engineering alien technology, and the other one is a qualitative jump forward in artificial intelligence. You know, people are very concerned about the future of artificial intelligence. I am frankly more concerned about the present of human stupidity.
Thank you.
Will we make it until the computers take over?
Yeah.
Then I have a different outlook. People like my friend Ray Kurzweil and others talk about how by 2045, computer systems will likely be sentient and self-aware, which is basically could be dystopian like The Matrix, for which my brother did the visual effects, or it could be utopian. But it's difficult because you have consciousness and you have machine capabilities. And what people are focusing on is machine capabilities somehow acquiring consciousness, either as a internal emergent property or somebody grafting it into them by way of some super smart algorithm. But I think it will happen the other way. We humans have consciousness, and it's only a matter of time before we adopt in ourselves more and more machine capabilities. There's Neuralink, you know, an Elon Musk company and others that are working on having basically a receptor in your brain to the internet that's directly hardwired to the internet. We have pacemakers. We already have other types of machines that go in our body. We're going to have more and more of those. So to me, will computers become self-aware? I think so. But will humans adopt more and more machine capabilities? Well, that's already happening.
Yeah.
So at some point in the not-too-distant future, you'll have humans who already have consciousness now have machine capabilities, the likes of which we can't imagine now, and that will become what we have looked at in the future as machines being self-aware, but I think it's going in the other direction first.
I'm still swimming in a little bit of trepidation there. I love the way that you language
it's
that.
It's not necessarily
though.
Good or bad, right?
Yeah.
Now, you know, we talk about AI. Will it be indifferent to humans? Will it be cold and calculating? Well, now, in the vision, in the future that I envision, it will be humans having those capabilities. So they'll be just as good and bad as they are now.
Well, we don't have a great track record in the way we solve conflict and how we get things done. It's always resorts to violence and killing, and we call it heroic and, you know, willing to pay the ultimate sacrifice. But in the end, it's still killing and destroying as a way to solve conflict. And if you have that mentality and back it up with supercomputing abilities, it seems scary to me. And you mentioned The Matrix. I just have to say, I watched that movie about a week ago again. I haven't seen it in about 5 years. That movie is a miracle, especially for 1998 when it was created in 1999. When I forgot that it even mentioned AI and some of these bits of dialogue, Agent Smith and everything describing, speaking for AI intelligence. And it's like spooky, spot on. I mean,
it's a wonderful movie. And, you know, so my brother created what I think is the most iconic visual effect in all of movies, which is the bullet time effect in The Matrix.
Yeah.
And after he cracked that code and figured that out, the company he's working for said, "Hey, Joel, you figure that out. Why don't you go work on this other movie?" So he did. And then his assistant won the Oscar for visual effects for The Matrix for the work my brother had done. Mm. But the other movie my brother went to was called What Dreams May Come, and he won the Oscar for that.
Mm.
Oh, wow.
Incredible. Man, you have lived quite the Forrest Gumpy kind of life.
I think they worked on No. Somebody bought my mom's house that worked visual effecting, but it wasn't that movie.
And my analogy is bad. I'm going to still say I'm the Forrest Gumpy because I'm just an ignorant shuffling my way through life. This guy's super smart.
Super smart. but Paul, you are such an incredible guest. I love your passion for life. I love how you witness and celebrate. Eric always uses that term. That is it, Ray Bradbury.
Ray
that
Bradbury.
Gave you that,
he
says
told
that
me
we are here to witness and celebrate.
He told me that to my face. I got to ask him, "Why are we here on this planet?" And he took off his glasses very thoughtfully. I thought he was going to go into this long dissertation, and he said, "Eric, we are here to witness and celebrate." And I'm like,
that's
holy
really cool. That's
isn't it?
And I see that in you, Paul. I do. I see that in you by the way that you are just witnessing and celebrating life and why you want to extend your life. As far as my thoughts on AI, because there's not a lot of regulation there, I feel like, you know, one of my biggest concerns is that, you know, getting in the wrong hands and not using it responsibly could really be a bad thing for humanity and could, you know, cause our own extinction at some point. So how do we get to that place that, you know, we bypass the stupidity in some of the areas that you talked about?
Yeah, and the adage that always has come to mind to me with AI is Murphy's Law, the literal definition of Murphy's Law. If there is something that can go wrong in this project, in this design, in this invention, it eventually will go wrong. And I'm like, this is a big, scary thing to go wrong.
At a lot of these conferences that we're all going to and we're all involved with, I think it's an important topic that we bring up the AI conversation just to start the dialogue on where do we go from here, because it's here. It's not in the distant future. No. It's way more evolved than we even knew.
And evolving so fast. Now that I read an article, ChatGPT is like old school. Yeah. You know, the first version 4 months later, and it's like, oh, well, that was then. It's happening so rapidly.
Yeah. Do you know anything about that as far as astronomy goes, about the massive black hole and the inner core of the Earth spinning faster I'm talking about people like that on a daily basis. I'm saying, okay, so time is doing something because it seems to be moving really fast. Isn't there some scientific explanation on why it feels like things are happening faster?
Oh boy, that's trippy. I don't know.
Cool. We're on a mission to find somebody who does.
I will throw 2 cents into that because I forget if it was Terrence McKenna. I think it was Terrence McKenna. And he says, when nothing happens, time goes by very slow because time is the interval between events. So very little is happening. Feels like a lot of time has gone by. If you have a whole bunch of events and you're measuring time by event to event to event, then all of a sudden that same, what we would call the same span of time, if there was a bunch of events in it, felt like it was going quicker because it was measured between all those micro events in it. How's that? Was that a good explanation?
Paul? I'm just here to witness and celebrate.
Another way is like, Eric, why don't you just shut up? You don't know what you're talking about.
Oh my gosh. I love it. Paul, that was great. Great comeback. Well, we are so looking forward to seeing you this Friday at Contact in the Desert.
For sure.
And inviting all of our listeners, if you don't have your tickets, I think they're not on sale online anymore, and you got to get them at the door. But they're having their kickoff party Thursday night. Eric and I are kicking off all of Contact in the Desert Thursday afternoon at Giant Rock.
Yeah.
Yep, the first event. We're right out the door. We're going to set the tone.
Can people just come for a day and buy a day ticket?
I think to go to the Giant Rock Tour, they have to have a weekend pass.
No, not that. If they want to come on Saturday because they were only available Saturday, could they come and buy a Saturday pass?
I think there might be. I haven't looked. I'm not part of the admin team that knows those things.
Anyway, it's a huge event. It's a party. It's a gathering. We were on the radio show last week with the head of Contact Now. And
Captain Paul. Captain Ron.
Captain Ron. This is Captain Paul. This is Admiral Paul we're talking to. Captain Ron answers to Admiral Paul. What a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much. And we look forward to, or I certainly look forward to seeing you out at Contact and saying hi and shaking your hand.
Likewise. It's going to be a lot of fun.
For sure.
All right, Paul. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. We'll have you back on to talk a little bit more, do a deeper dive in each one of these categories here.
We sure could.
Okay, cool. I just checked my schedule and I'm free that night.
I like the way this guy thinks and talks, for sure. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Sure.
What a fascinating human being.
I knew you were going to like him. I really did.
I was blown away.
You didn't even know who he was
when
I mentioned his name.
And as you read the bio, I was just, you know, when you just an avalanche of information, I was just like, holy moly. Usually if you go to a restaurant that offers every type of food, you go, none of that can be any good.
Yeah, can I have some scrambled eggs, please? Yeah, I know.
And
exactly.
When you read this guy's bio, he's done this and this and this. And I go, well, we'll see. And wow.
I had to read it to you while you were driving from the mountain today because I booked him yesterday and I always had a sense that I wanted to have him on the show ever since I met him in February. But when I saw that I was introducing him, I thought I need to have him on the show so I get a feel for who he is because I can't read all that as I'm introducing him. I need to just kind of.
Just hit the high points and don't read anything.
I'm not reading for you either, Eric. Yeah. I'm going to do my little intro the way I did at Portal to Ascension.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I knew that he was going to leave us feeling buzzy.
Yeah.
And instead of like tired and draggy,
yes.
He just got in there and he leaves you feeling high.
Makes
a little
me
bit
feel
high.
Like if I had money, I'd go buy some Bitcoin, but you know, they'll be us.
All of our listeners, can we all pitch in
and
we'll
buy
own
one.
Bitcoin? We'll own one Bitcoin. We need 28,000 of our, did he say it was 28,000 for one Bitcoin? Is
so if we had 28,000 listeners, y'all pitch in a dollar.
That's right.
If it goes up to $1 million, that's a pretty good return on investment.
There we go. Yeah. I think that we're putting it out there. Got to get creative these days.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. We have another great show next week. And
we have Gary Christmas on next week.
Oh, yeah. And we want to thank you for tuning in. We have a Facebook page. We're on all the socials that our amazing admin manages. Colleen does everything for the show that supports the show. I mean, the true legwork that keeps this show running, Colleen does. And
even while
she
was out of town, she created the show.
Thank you so much, Colleen. So, and in the interim, we're doing our best, and we hope you are as well, too.
Be good humans.
So long, everybody.
This is Eric Rankin
and Michelle Anderson from Awakening Code Radio
right here on KXFM.
We'd like to invite you to join a conversation to raise the vibration.
Broadcasting live every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m., we cover all aspects of the process of awakening, whether it's emotional or spiritual growth.
And have hosted such luminaries as Deepak Chopra, Marianne Williamson, James Redfield, and many others.
With a global audience, our show is one of the most listened to programs here at KXFM.
And we would love for you to join the conversation.